Good evening. Nice to see so many people interested in the way of freedom. My own perspective on Buddhism, obviously, is as a monk. And in Theravada Buddhism, we use what we call the Pali Canon, which is the old scriptures that come, we think, from the time of the Buddha. And in that, the Buddha gives most of his teaching to monastics, because these were the people who could be closest to him, monks and nuns, who could live the lifestyle that he recommended to be close to him. The teachings applied to everyone. A lot of teachings were given to the lay people, but the great bulk of it was to monastics because they were around. You could teach them. When the Buddha was close to death, he was asked, "Who do you leave as your heir?" It's a monk that you leave as the kind of Dharma heir. And he said, "I don't leave any person. I leave the Dhamma Vinaya." And the Dhamma is the teachings, and the Vinaya is the discipline. So what he left in place was a social structure and a teaching. And this was what he recommended the monastic community follow. And that's always been very, very important to me, that the Buddha's way is not just somehow in separate from one's ordinary life, somehow different from living with people, different from living in society. It's very much conjoined with that, very much part of that. Obviously, the monastic community that could live near him were able to set up a rather unique lifestyle, partially because they lived on alms food. So monastics don't have any money. This solves a lot of problems. So the monastic community would be dependent on lay people for food. They would wander into the villages, receive food, and go back into the forests. At the time of the Buddha, there were two main religious traditions. One was the Brahmana tradition, which was the kind of Brahmanic priestly tradition, and there were what they call the Samanas, and these were wanderers, different kinds of religious wanderers who had all kinds of practices, all kinds of ways that they did things. The Brahmins were the priests, and the Samanas were like shamans. They're kind of some of the original shamans in India. And the Buddha was one of those. Shramana has the same kind of a linguistic roots as shaman, which is interesting, isn't it? So in India at that time you found all kinds of interesting matted hair ascetics and naked ascetics, and Mahavira, the Jain ascetic, was there, and the Buddha. And the people who chose to take the Buddha's teaching were called followers of the Buddha. Simply the kind of language that you used in the Samana tradition, whose teaching do you follow? And the person would say, "I follow teachings of Gautama." Quite simple. So the question of religion or not religion, like this is one of the questions that comes up in Buddhism, is Buddhism a religion or not? That word didn't even exist at that time. People just say, I follow Mahavira, I follow Gautama, I follow someone else, Alara Kalama, these different names that we have through history. So you get these kinds of questions coming up, is Buddhism a religion, is it not, and so on, which are really pointless. Because if you define it as a religion, fine. If you don't define it as a religion, fine. The point is there's a teaching, there's a way to do this, there's a practice. And quite often, the mistake that beings make around religion is they take it as a kind of opinion, or they take it as a position, But the point of the way the Buddha taught in the text was very pragmatic. He would always deal with situations. So he never really kind of, you know, he wasn't like Hegel or Marx or someone who wrote up some kind of philosophy which covered everything. It was very, very pragmatic. He dealt with a particular situation with particular people at particular times. Then over the centuries, over the 2.5 millennia, a lot of this has been systematized and fixed in various kinds of philosophical ways. But one of the things I like about the Buddha's way is it's not a teaching of absolutes. It's not like questions around how did the universe begin? The Buddha wouldn't answer. So he wasn't trying to answer everything. He'd said, I teach suffering and its end. I teach suffering and its end. And so the monastic community weren't a priestly caste. They didn't have some kind of special position with truth that you had to go through. You had to go through the priest to get to the truth. Everyone has access to truth. And the monastic community practice in a particular way, the lay community practice in a particular way. So I'm not a priest, and I don't have some magic wand or some access to truth. The irony of it is in traditional Buddhist countries, the monk has become a priest in many ways. He's got to do all kinds of rituals so that people can have a good rebirth or all kinds of things like that. But that's really not what the Buddha was teaching. He was teaching a way of suffering and the end of suffering. Okay, very, very simple. So in the text, you get that quite often stated. I teach suffering, I teach the end of suffering. Sometimes you get statements like, the mind is luminous. Its luminosity is blocked by defilements. So there's a very optimistic underpinning to this teaching. The mind is luminous. You know, the human beings have this kind of possibility, but it's blocked by defilements. Sometimes the teaching would be put out like there is the deathless. There is the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed. There is the cave. There is safety, there's peace. It was put in that way. And this is the transcendent way of talking about Buddhism. One of the things you get in interreligious dialogue is like, Buddhism doesn't believe in a God. Right? Yeah, that's the kind of... of course, no one knows what God means. And if you get an argument about God or so on, do Buddhists not believe in God? Well, what is God? So a Buddhist says, I believe in Nirvana. But what does that mean? So again, if you just take a position, Buddhists do or do not believe in God, it doesn't really matter. Again, what is the deathless say? What did the Buddha realize through that? What is the transcendent? What is that in human? What is it about human beings that we aspire to something very profound and very deep, and all religions seem to touch it in some ways, all mystical, you know, you read about the mystical traditions in different ways. Whether it's Rumi or St. John of the Cross or Ajahn Chah, whoever, what have these beings realized? You know, they've realized something very, very profound. And so I think, for me, each tradition couches that realization in different ways. And I always, for any tradition I go to, if I'm shopping around for traditions, I'm not shopping for traditions, but it's fun to read about saints and so on, I always look for the best. You know, why look at the worst in a tradition and say that's what the tradition is about? So if there's some narrow-minded Buddhist, you know, I don't want to be related to that. But then why should I maybe blame Christianity for some narrow-minded Christian or Islam for some narrow-minded Muslim? You know, so a particular take on a religion isn't necessarily truth. What a particular person or a particular group says about a particular religion isn't necessarily the deepest and profoundest realization in that tradition. At least that's the way I see it. Because like in our monastery in England, we get really good dialogue with Christian monks and nuns that come to us, and it's really fun. It's really interesting. Say, what are you seeing? You know, beyond all our stuff about God and Nirvana, You know, what have you seen, and what have you realized, and how do you practice, and how do you deal with difficulties in the kitchen anyway, and you know, all of that. So when you know, when we take religion beyond just the sort of dogmatic arguments that you see, then of course we're being more kind of reflective, aren't we? We're being more contemplative. We're contemplating at a deeper level. And the word religion sometimes gets bad press, but this is what my vision of religion is. It is a realization of something profound and deep in the human heart, which is ineffable, which has to be seen each one for ourselves. In Buddhism, nirvana or nibbana or the deathless is something that is possible in human consciousness. So it's not dualistic. It's not like I'm here now, and then if I keep chipping away, you know, over there in time, I'm going to realize nibbana. Nibbana has to be something about here and now. So in religious language, we talk about transcendence and immanence. Immanence means it's here now. Transcendence is it's interesting. Transcendence means what? Does it mean that we get out of it all? That's what I used to think transcendence means. It means if I realize a transcendent, I won't have any hassles. No pain, no arguments in the kitchen, everyone will love me. but that's not what transcendence really means. Transcendence means like being in the midst of it all, but not being overwhelmed by it, not being burdened by it, being free within the complexities of life. And that transcendent realization in Buddhism, we say awareness is the path to the deathless. Awareness is the path to the deathless. And that's the kind of nub of Buddhist practice, awareness. It's the path to the deathless. And now awareness you can only do now. You can't do it tomorrow. Alright? Try to do awareness tomorrow. You know, you look, you know, you make a determination, tomorrow I'll start practicing awareness. So awareness has to be now, with the way things are. And so that's the way this meditation began, with just, well, what is it like, what does the room feel like, the heat, or the cold, or whatever you're feeling, and what is the body like, and what is the mood of the mind? Now these are very, very ordinary things. You know, they're not complex. You don't have to kind of read millions of texts to just be present. But how many could do it for 10 minutes? Just to be here now with just the ordinariness. I don't know. Should I better not do a survey. I'm embarrassing. But it's difficult, isn't it? Mind goes off, you know, future plans, da-da-da-da-da, goes back into resentments. To be present in the moment is very, very difficult. Extraordinarily difficult. And why is that? Well, because one of the great reasons that it's difficult to be present, because we're not trained. We're not really trained. Because we don't tend to get training in meditation, in awareness. We tend to get, like, we get trained maybe to analyze and to think. And I don't know, you're trained to think or not? To really think clearly? I suppose so. We're trained to become a lot, to get a goal or to get rid of something. So there's a lot of kind of time-bound structures in our minds. So goals to get to or things to achieve and all of that. But just to be present in the moment in a very simple way is often very elusive. And so the reason I became a Buddhist monk was for the training. Not to become a priest or not to get a nice Sri Lankan meal every day. Although I'm very well taken care of. I mean, that wasn't the point of it. That's the kind of extra that came I didn't expect. But to train, you know, to train. Not to just learn about Buddhism. I wasn't interested. I'd done so much study, you know, not very successfully, but so many years in school, the idea of putting more information into my head just gave me a headache. And I may have to stuff another 5 years of stuff into my head. Yeah. My teacher said, stop reading for 5 years. I realized how addicted I was to reading, of course. To stop reading and read this. Read this, read your heart, you know, understand that. And then, you know, then maybe you can read a text. I cheated a bit. I did read, but I took it to heart. I realized that I can get all the information in my head I want, but so what? It'll be just yet another theory, someone else's idea. So what we try to do in Buddhist study is actually to study something and then reflect on it. And this is different than just accumulating information. This is a great difference in that. Because I know for myself, I always think, well, if I just get a little more information, then I'll be a little more enlightened. But all I have is more information. But to actually take one bit of information, one bit of teaching, and then really, really go deeply with that, really reflect upon it. This is using intellect and awareness, which I was talking about last week, the idea of discernment and awareness, discernment and awareness. So a lifestyle is a training, a religious training. So in the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which is suffering, there is suffering, there is the cause of suffering, there's an end of suffering, and there's the path leading to the end of suffering. These are Four Noble Truths, and this is the kind of fundamental structure which one tries to really absorb in the Buddhist path. There is suffering, and that suffering can be discontent, annoyance, boredom, grief, you know, all the various ways that we can suffer as human beings. It can be great or small, lesser or major or minor. It has a cause. It doesn't just pop up arbitrarily. It's not just a bad joke. You know, there's a causal relationship. There's an end to suffering. So sometimes, I just read the book by the Pope where he, what's it called? Something. He wrote it about a few years ago. He makes comments on
crossing the threshold.
So, that's it. He makes comments about Islam and about other forms. And in Buddhism, he painted as a nihilistic religion. And it was very negative, life denying. He doesn't understand. But I couldn't, you know, that's all right. That's his problem. But. But that's when you get that. You get someone making a comment about another religion where they didn't understand. The Buddhism is not nihilistic. Nihilism was one of the extremes that the Buddha spoke against. Buddhism has a very, very profound insight. So there is an end to suffering. It's not some kind of existentialism without, you know, just this hopeless mess we're in. There is an end to suffering. So actually, this kind of optimism, this kind of aspiration, I think is the heart of the religious life. Because if we don't have optimism, if we don't have some sense of aspiration, how can we do the work? If you don't really believe in goodness, where are you going to get the energy to practice? You have to believe in goodness, don't you? We have to believe that we have to believe that we have some kind of potential and possibility, and that kind of gives one the energy to do the work, because it's hard work. The religious life isn't easy, dealing with one's own limitations and with the things that come up into consciousness, with the emotions, with the pain that the body has, and all these things. It's not easy. So for me, that third noble truth, that there is an end to suffering, is this teacher saying, you know, that I've realized something. And then he says, the fourth noble truth is a path. Which is nice, isn't it? He didn't just kind of say, tough for you guys, I'm out of here, I'm in the forest. But he actually said, there is a path. You can practice this. And this is why I became a monk, to travel that path, to train in that particular way. I had read a lot of the existentialists when I was in university, and that kind of struck me very deeply. But then I thought, God, this is depressing. There's no way out. It's just kind of painting this kind of difficult picture that humanity might get itself into, but it doesn't get you out. So then, what was it? Marcuse went into communism, I think, or whatever. So the guy went into politics. So that's not a way out. Politics isn't the way out, is it? So then when I came across Buddhism, that there is an end to suffering, there's a path. And so the path is couched as the Noble Eightfold Path, which many of you have read about. And what I'd like to talk about in the Noble Eightfold Path is right effort. It's the kind of the way to train the mind, the way to make this life one where we train, where we cultivate, where we lay a foundation for enlightenment, where we lay a foundation for freedom. To understand what right effort, I think the basic thing that we need to consider is that that the reason we suffer is causally related. There's a cause. Right? And when we talk about suffering, we're not talking about merely unpleasant experience. Unpleasant experience is a given. So you know, the fact that I have a toothache is maybe physical discomfort, but in this sense of suffering, it's not suffering. What suffering is, the tension and the attachments I have to that, what I create around the toothache, worry or tension in the body or whatever it is. So pain is not suffering. Pain is unpleasant, but pain is not the point of it. And the piece of wisdom that the Buddha realized is the peace which knows the truth of happiness and unhappiness. The peace of wisdom is the peace that knows the truth of happiness and unhappiness. It knows that happiness arises and ceases because of causes, and that unhappiness arises and ceases because of causes, or pain. And these things come and go. But that which knows that and doesn't, is not bound to that, and doesn't get caught by that, and doesn't get attached to that, and doesn't believe in that, is where we find the transcendent peace. Huh? So, what do we do in a consumer society? So we chase the pleasant, don't we? We seek pleasant experiences. We seek perfect relationships and nice-looking bodies and clever IBM computers or whatever, right? So it's a kind of seeking of the pleasant. So what the Buddha did then, he said, when you're suffering, observe the cause of suffering. So cause and effect, right? When you're suffering, observe the cause of suffering in your own heart. And so this requires personal responsibility. You have to kind of take that on board, don't you? So if I'm feeling bored at a Buddhist lecture in this temple, right? Let's say if any of you are feeling bored now, you could feel that I'm a creep. Okay, that's allowed. You could feel guilty. I'm a good Buddhist. I should be enjoying this. Or you could say, this is suffering. This discontent I'm feeling is suffering. Now that's a big step, isn't it? That's a big step. Because what do we usually do, or often what we do with suffering, is we distract or blame. Right? So, you know, if you feel bored, you're kind of someone behind the pillars reading Time magazine or something, you know. Or you walk out, or you just endure. Just kind of endure. But endurance isn't wisdom. You know, water buffaloes endure a lot. So wisdom is this ability to, in this case, to reflect on the, well, first of all, to make conscious that I'm suffering. Even if it's in a minor way. Now, if you do that, and if we do that, we get into the habit of that, then life takes on much more meaning, doesn't it? Because then, you know, all the hassles that we have in life become the path. There, you know, those very frictions, of course, which is an adage nowadays, I suppose, are really the things that are awakening us. Because when it's pleasant, we often fall asleep. I mean, sometimes, you know, some people do reflect in pleasantness, but sometimes it's just so great you don't reflect. You just go for it. But when it's unpleasant, when you've got the stone in your shoe, what do? You want to get the stone out, don't you? And so this ability to make conscious the fact that there is discontent, that there is some feeling of dis-ease in some way, is the beginning of freedom. There's a possibility there. And that is a kind of, in terms of right effort, that's the effort to, that's the effort of remembering that. And that's Remembrance Day. We can remember history, we can remember people who have died in war and honor that And we can also try to remember being here now. Because we do forget, don't we? We get lost. We go off into all kinds of things. But to remember to be here now. And so when there is friction, to not blame it, not blame oneself, not blame others, to not distract it, but to know this is suffering. This is what it feels like. Yeah, for me, I think that's a big step in humanity. Obviously, if there's social injustice and that, we need to address that, obviously. So I'm not talking about, you know, those kinds of things. But, you know, in a normal kind of circumstance of life. So the suffering has a cause, and the cause is this sense of attachment. And attachment is a word which is much, much maligned, I think, or misunderstood in Buddhism. Upadana in Pali. Attachment to what? Attachment to, basically attachment to desire. Attachment to wanting things other than they are. So one of the phrases I use a lot is, what is it that you want that you don't have? And what is it that you don't want that you do have? What is it that you want that you don't have, and what is it that you don't want that you do have, right? Simple enough. That's a very good mantra. If you can bring that mantra up, at least you can then get in focus what you're feeling and why you're resisting this moment. And then if it's socially necessary, you can leave, fine, you can change, you can distract and all of that. But at least if you know the cause of suffering, then when you act on that, you'll be able to see the result. So if I'm meditating and I'm feeling restless, right? And I rationalize, well, actually, I don't think meditation is good for me. I'm out of here, right? I need to, you know, do the knitting or something, or I need to wash my socks. You rationalize that restless mind. You never really see restless as you do some. But if you know, I feel restless now, I don't want to do this, and you get up and go, then at least you'll see how you're reacting. Or, I feel restless now, I don't want to sit still, and you start fidgeting. You see, what is the result of fidgeting? In meditation is, you feel more restless. You see, with this kind of condition, you get this kind of result. If I feel restless, I say, I don't want to sit still. And I put something else in it. Just be calm. Relax, relax. And I watch that, and I see how the restlessness ends. I see cause and effect, cause and effect. So if I'm noticing the cause of suffering, the attachment I have to wanting things other than they are, and I act on that, and that action gives me more suffering, I'm going to learn. But if I never see the cause, or I misplace the cause, then I can just keep acting in ways which perpetuate the suffering. Blame, say. Let's say I say in the monastery, someone is blaming someone else, right? And they're feeling angry about something. Maybe, you know, there's some truth to it, but as long as they keep believing in the blame and they keep feeding the anger, there's no freedom from anger. And they might feel justified and all that. But if they say, why? Well, what's going on? What is it that I want that I don't have? Well, I want that person to be different. I want that person to be other than they are. Then at least I know, oh, that's the wanting. That's the wanting. The wanting now is to want that person to be more... We live in our monastery in England. We have about 20 men. And we live in a school which was built by the Canadian Army, which has wooden floors. And it looked kind of long barracks buildings. And we live beside each other in little rooms. And we have two types of walkers in the monastery. We have elephant walkers... And other walkers, and elephant walkers are not popular because they make a lot of noise. And so, you know, you're sitting there meditating and the elephant comes by and you kind of bounced off your cushion. So then, of course, the angry mind says, I'm unhappy because that creep is an elephant walker, and if I'm going to give him, I'm going to next meet him, I'm going to tell that guy to stop being an elephant walker. Yeah, it's true, but why am I suffering? I'm suffering because I want that guy to walk quietly. So we have, you know, we have meetings every week where we can talk about these things, about elephant walking, and it's a common topic that comes up. But if I'm sitting there on that cushion, and I'm just watching, I'm watching my mind and say, what is it I want that I don't have? I want quiet. And what is it that I don't want that I do have? It's that elephant. Then I can see, well, what am I creating? This is the way it is now. There's this sound, there's this situation. And what am I creating on top of that? What am I adding on top of that? And that's what we mean by attachment. It's that what I'm creating on top of this situation. And if I do that, and I train with that, you know, then I can learn to be at peace with elephants. Now that's easy, isn't it? Some things are more difficult. You get, you know, difficult people, abusive people, and so on. So obviously we need good social structures and so on, but always that's something you can fall back to. You can always go back to that and use the situation of stress or suffering to go beyond suffering, to see cause and effect. Let's say, like all the things around desire, say consumerism. I want this thing. I want a new CD or I want a better CD player or whatever. Fine, go for it. But at least look at wanting. So the you know, there's the sound, you hear the sound, and you think, that's pleasant. We like the pleasant, don't we? That's nice. And of course, we want to own the pleasant and keep the pleasant. So how do I keep the pleasant? I buy one of those. Hear the sound, that's pleasant. How can I want something? So I buy it. So I buy it and I put it on. Of course, how long does that pleasantness last? Before, of course, but I need a sandwich too, right? And that's the kind of little things we're watching now. Just like wanting something, but maybe, well, this is a feeling of wanting to buy something. And it's not immoral to want to buy something. It's not that. It's not kind of being stupid about it. But it's actually like feeling, the very feeling of wanting. This is a feeling of wanting something. Huh? And what is attachment to that? And what happens if I follow the wanting? And what happens if I renounce the wanting? What if I practice renunciation? What happens to me then? What is the peace of renunciation as a peace to ownership? Does ownership really bring me peace? Or does it make it a kind of a problem? Where am I going to put this damn thing now anyway? And my house is so full that I need a garage now, or... And it goes on and on. Or I need to use this thing now. I need to, you know, all the complexities you get around owning things and getting things. Now, without making any kind of moral statement about that, how does that work in the mind? How does that work? And what leads to peace and what doesn't lead to peace? What is it that I want that I don't have? And what is it I don't want that I do have? So around right effort, what we're trying to do is to develop skillfulness, and this I talked about last week. What is skillful in your life, right? And what is unskillful? So when we talk about right effort, we talk about the effort to abandon unskillful things that have already manifested in your mind or in your life. So the effort to abandon. And then the effort to prevent unskillful things from coming into your life. To prevent the unskillful which has not yet arisen. And then the effort to sustain the good things that have come up into your life, and the effort to manifest good things that have not yet come up. And these are always very present efforts, very present efforts. So if I'm feeling resentful, say, yeah, I can know that resentment. I can feel it in my body. How do I abandon something unskillful? How do you give something up? And that's very important, because you get into all kinds of issues like repression, denial, feeling guilty, or then indulging, getting lost in. What, how do you abandon something unskillful? Because we do have unskillful things, right? We have states of mind which are maybe divisive or cruel or malicious or whatever it might be. And we see them, don't we? We don't like them. If you're on a spiritual path, you don't like to feel jealous. Who likes to feel malicious? Who likes resentment? I mean, who likes greed, really? It's such a restless thing. And these things come up into consciousness. So first of all, we have to see, well, if I pursue this particular state of mind, it will lead to my suffering and to the suffering of others. So there has to be some sense of seeing that. Like a person that's angry. A person that believes in their anger and just pursues anger and feels justified in their anger, there's no way out. There's no way out, is there? And some people are very angry for good causes. You know, they might have been really hurt by life and they feel very, very angry. But there's no way out. As long as they believe in anger, as long as they believe in blame, there's just no way out, is there? Guilt around anger also doesn't work, because that's hating oneself for anger. So how do I abandon anger that has arisen? How do I abandon that? How do I give that up without repressing it, without indulging it? And this is the middle way, which is, it's difficult to figure out sometimes, isn't it? You can get the theory, but when you're in the grip of some of this stuff, it's very hard to find that middle way. The middle way between repression and indulgence. Now personally, I like to use the body a lot. I find the body is such a wonderful reference for all the things that come up into consciousness. Because I can feel anger in the body, right? And I can, like I was saying this last week, I take it into the head. Now I find that if there is some really negative, unskillful state of mind which has come up, and I can be aware of it in my guts or in my body, that's the abandoning of it. Because what I'm doing is I'm not feeding it anymore. I'm not pursuing it with thought. I'm not believing in it. I'm seeing it as part of my karma, as something which has arisen because of causes. And it can end. It will end. Because I'm not feeding it with thought. I'm not feeding it with belief. I'm not believing it. I'm aware of it. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. So if I'm really mindful of that anger, that very anger takes me to peace. That's the strange thing about this. You think, and I used to think, well, this anger is preventing me from being peaceful. Yeah, in a way, yeah. But how do I use that to go to peace? And it's by being aware of it. And if I can be aware of, say, anger, and sustain that awareness with full compassion, because it takes a lot of compassion to be aware of that, to feel that, then what happens is anger ceases. Suffering ends. There is cessation. And that ceasing of suffering condition is what we mean by nirvana or nibbana. It's the end of something. And when we see the end of something, we see this lovely peace in the mind. Not because we got rid of it, because we endured it. We endured it with wisdom. We saw it as unskillful. The same with like wanting. You know, if I really want, like, say, monastic life, you get a lot of... So you get a young man going into monastic life. He's 25 and he's lives a celibate life. There's no music. There's no distractions. You have the same chanting every day, one meal a day. You're lucky if you get it, you know, in Thailand, a cup of coffee once a week. No English people to speak to. Can you imagine the restlessness? There was desire for this and desire for that. And so what do you do with that? What do you do with desire? Unfulfilled desire. Now much of culture says, well, fulfill the desire. Go for it. You have to fulfill yourself in whatever way they say that. But what about witnessing to desire? What about actually like feeling unfulfilled desire? What happens there? Well, the Buddha's suggestion is that in the witnessing of unfulfilled desire, desire ceases, and in the cessation there's peace. And it's the peace which is not from control or manipulation or distraction, but it's the peace of emptiness, of relinquishment, of abandonment, of nibbana. It's a different kind of peace. Because it's something that is there if we're willing to wait. You know, the religious life requires trust, it requires waiting, these kinds of things. But the thing about unfulfilled desire is that it's a restless kind of energy. It's very difficult to bear with it. But if you bear witness to that, you see, what is it that I want? Because this is the feeling of wanting. Mindfulness of wanting leads to the deathless. You begin to realize the end of wanting. So this is the idea of abandonment. And wanting, all kinds of wanting, you'll feel that in the body too. If the tension in the shoulders, take it up into your head and it'll just go into the storyline of what you want. And then you'll feel maybe you shouldn't want that. And then you have an argument up there. I shouldn't want that. Yes, but I want it. But that won't work. But in the body, wanting feels this way. The body's really good that way. Body awareness is, the Buddha really, he really praised body awareness a lot. There's a lot of suttas actually about body awareness, because you can register it all. So that's the idea of abandoning, preventing the unskillful from coming into your consciousness. We say that to our children, don't we? Don't watch television. Preventing the unskillful from arising, you know, preventing, like when you see a state of mind which you know really, really well, and you know it's unskillful, you don't have to analyze it. You say, no, I don't believe you anymore. I just refuse to buy into that anymore. It's not repression. It's not denial. You know it, but you just refuse to buy into it. So sometimes you'll see that in the work that you do with yourself, sometimes it'll just be a kind of niggling echo. But just don't believe it. Don't give it an inch. I refuse to believe you. You know, you get some kind of, you know, the kind of self-disparaging stuff that we get around ourselves. Viradhammo, you're no good. I don't believe you. Just refuse that into the mind. It's very important to do that. Refuse to believe stupidity. Refuse to believe ignorance. Refuse to believe ego views. I am great is an ego view. I'm a basket case is an ego view. I'm enlightened is an ego view. I'm not enlightened is an ego view. It's just thought. So any thought that I'm good or I'm bad is just thought. That's all it is. I'm too fat, I'm too skinny, you know, my ears are too big. I didn't do that well, I did that very well, all that. It's just thought. That's all it is, just thought. It comes and it goes. Believe it, and you can get reborn with it. Right? Believe the thought that I'm no good, and you can take that, you know, carry it around for a week. And that's rebirth. You take a thought, and you churn it up, you keep pumping it out, and you get reborn. It's whatever you want. But just to know a thought is a thought, and refuse it to believe in it. Now that has to be done with skill. You learn how to do that. It's not repressive. So sometimes the feelings are very powerful, and you just have to bear witness to them. You just have to be very patient. But sometimes they're not. They're just soap bubbles. They're not true. They kind of refuse to kind of buy into that. So that's around the negative, effort around the negative. Around the positive, there's the effort to sustain and the effort to manifest. So obviously things like morality is a very positive thing to cultivate. Good morals, good ethics. And to sustain like wholesome practices, meditation, to sustain wholesome thoughts, to sustain wholesome disciplines, to sustain wholesome friendships. There's so much of goodness in us that we can sustain. This is what I found, say, in the monastic community. Like my teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, he is an incredibly disciplined man in a very, very soft way. You'd never know it. But he's, you know, he like does his yoga every morning. He gets up around 2 or 3, I don't know, some ungodly hour. We usually get up at 4. He gets up at 2 or 3, and he's done like a lot of yoga and a lot of sitting before he starts the day. And he's got a lot to do, and he's got a lot on. He's got a big monastery, constant problems all day, and that's what he uses for his practice. You know, he really uses that. But what does he do? He's got this really. He sustains good practices. And then just talking to him, how he sustained like yoga for 30, 40 years and sustained meditation, a lot of, you know, morning and evening, these good things that we can sustain. Sustaining like kind of trainings we get as monastics. We're trained to reflect on, like, because I'm an alms mendicant, I couldn't survive without the goodness of the laity. Like this robe is all given. It's all given. This watch is given. This was given. That lift was given. It's all given. It's all given. I just kind of walking around as a kind of gift parcel. Wrapped up. Now, if I reflect on that, you know, this is, that this alms suit has been offered. These robes have been offered. This roof of my head has been offered. This air ticket has been offered. So on and so forth. That brings up gratitude, doesn't it? Now, that doesn't mean that I'm always grateful. You know, I mean, I would like some Velcro. Something. So, I mean, there's that which whinges in me. You know, that which, nyeh, nyeh, I don't like this, nyeh. But is that something I really want to sustain? You know, is that what I want to get reborn as? A kind of whinging whatever? No, but so I have to be honest. I have to know that. No, I really don't want to pursue that. I don't want to be like that. But then I can cultivate. I can bring forth the gratitude. Not as a kind of goody good thing. And this is where people, I think, get confused around religion. Because we've all heard it. Our parents told us to be grateful. You know, people in China are starving. Why don't you eat your potatoes? That kind of stuff. And so it becomes a sort of sentimentality, doesn't it? But that's not it. Like, gratitude is a very skillful state of mind, isn't it? Because when you're grateful, you're not greedy. You're not discontent when you're grateful. So to manifest that and to sustain that. And so we have chants like that. We actually chant. We reflect on the food that's offered. To be grateful for the food that's offered. To use food as medicine. And then that reflection done day in and day out, has a powerful effect on the mind. And is a mirror to that which is discontent, to which isn't satisfied, which isn't grateful, which complains. So it's not just kind of trying to be good and nice, but it's realizing there is unskillfulness. Abandon that. Don't let that rule your life. But there is skillfulness. Cultivate that. So like I was saying, that little story in the last talk I gave at the community health center, when I was reflecting on, you know, my mother had this accident, I talked about that, and then I really felt that in my heart, and rather than letting it go into worry, I just brought in all the pain of the world. And that was really, really had brought me a lot of kind of peace. It didn't get me depressed. It kind of really opened my heart. And then I went on to the third reflection, you know, around mudita, which is the reflection on sympathetic joy. Where then I contemplated my mother's good qualities, which brought me quite a lot of happiness. And then I just tried to think all the monastic community, all my friends. I just thought about their good qualities. And I wasn't being sentimental. You know, think, oh, aren't they lovely? I actually thought, he's really diligent. And she's really skillful, and I really just kept going with those kinds of thinking, and my mind became quite joyous. But that's a when others develop it, sustain it. This is a kind of effort. And this is an effort you do a day in and day out, in the moment. It's something you're always doing here now. Because where skillfulness lies is in intention. It's my intention which makes it skillful or unskillful. So I have to be very aware of my intentions. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And then what is the result of what I'm doing? So even if I am unskillful in my actions, if at least I'm aware of my intentions, I'll see that intention leads to my suffering. And I don't want to get burnt. I'm going to start to abandon that. I'll know for myself. I'll know clearly. So right effort then is abandonment and preventing the unskillful, sustaining and manifesting. Abandoning and preventing the unskillful, sustaining and bringing up the skillful. Something that you can do always in the moment. But you have to be very aware. You have to understand yourself. You can't just do it from judgment. You have to really know yourself. All right, I'll leave that for reflection and any questions anyone has.
I was extremely angry 2 weeks ago, consumed with anger. My car had been broken into, right through a locked car, completely locked, and the back seat had been torn out in order for the thief to get that purse, which he did. And I must admit that my thoughts against the thief were desperately unholy.
Yeah. Good man.
In Sword Tai Chi, I was slashing him to bits.
Yeah.
Etc., etc. All of this didn't really do me any good. It was most unskillful. And and I thought to my old Zen Buddhist teacher, saying, when you confront anger, let it burn you away. I don't think I fully understood.
But would you have done it?
Done what?
If you had the thief in front of you, would you have chopped his head off with a sword?
No.
Right.
No, not in the...
Exactly. So your intentions are... You know, that's I think that you have to, need to remember is that, yeah, we rage and that, yeah, but deep down, we'd never do that.
Deep down, I probably... I don't know, if I had caught him in the act, and if he hadn't stabbed me to death or anything like that, I would have asked him why he...
Why he did that, yeah.
Yes. Why would you want to do this?
You know, sometimes...
There's something I can give you, yeah, rather than have you steal it, you know?
You know that Zen story where that Zen monk comes in and he's very, very poor and his hut's been burgled, and then he looks into the door through the window and there it is. Oh, he forgot the moon. That's a nice one. But like you know, sometimes if you have a really strong emotion, you got to let the language run. It's all right, because you're not going to do it. So, you know, you do everything to him, but because it's so strong, you know, and the language is going to come up. And so what I do is a lot of walking, well, I haven't had that kind of race for a while, but I, you know, if there is anger or strong energy, I do walking meditation, just walk back and forth. And sometimes, I have done that. I've actually brought it because it's so powerful. But I know deep down I never do it. You know, so you sometimes you can do that. But then, if I keep dwelling on that with intention, then it's dangerous. You know, then each time it comes on, that. So, you know, when there's that kind of powerful energy, you just gotta let it burn you.
Then the bugger came back a second time. This time, having broken in, he obviously just, there was nothing in the car except an umbrella. So he took that.
Ooh.
So at this point, I thought, well, you know, you've made such an effort breaking in. I left nothing for you but an umbrella. You're welcome to it.
Yeah, and your heart was all right.
Yeah.
Well done.
So I thought, that was a very interesting turn of thought.
Yeah.
You know, from all the murderous thoughts the week before. And then just as he's contemplated, well, by this time she should have bought herself another handbag. And I'll have another go.
We have a Cambodian nun who escaped the horrors of Cambodia. Her husband was in the government, so he was killed. And much of her family were killed. She escaped, and she raised two kids in North Dakota. Imagine Cambodia, North Dakota. And she studied computer programming, became quite good at it. Ended up in Minnesota. Her kids, I think, then they went off to university, and she got a job with an NGO in Cambodia. Now, all this time, she had been having these deliberate thoughts about getting the Khmer Rouge and then cutting them as many small pieces as possible. You know, really vicious, vicious, consistent thinking. For years, she said, you did this. For years, she did this. And then, you know, she started to contemplate Dhamma. She says, I'm destroying myself. This is killing me. And her heart began to change because she realized, so what? You know, you can think all you want, but it's destroying her. And then as she really started to do more and more meditation, she felt bad about hurting them. Right? So then she was working in Phnom Penh, and she decided to... And the Khmer Rouge areas had now been kind of neutralized.
So she went up to one of these villages with a Khmer Rouge soldiers and she asked for forgiveness of the soldiers. Can you believe it? The courage of the woman. It makes you cry, doesn't it? But it was really sincere. It wasn't, you know, I mean, to do such a thing. But she had to work through that. You know, if some Buddhist would have said to her after she saw her husband killed, now have loving kindness for the killers, you know. You know, that's the kind of stupidity that you get sometimes. But so sometimes, you know, the rage is like that. But the realization finally came to her how it was destroying her. And she's about to be ordained in Amaravati. She's a great lady. More questions, anyone? Anyone? Yes.
In your discussion of skillfulness, when you really don't know what to do, when you're faced with a situation that you have no clue about, the only way you can be skillful is to do one meditation or something of that nature. But I'm thinking of a situation where one of my sons was deeply mired in the drug trade in Glasgow. I went over to spend time with him. And I entered a well I had no clue about. And the only thing I could do was to do one meditation. His room, and then in part afterwards when he came home, sort of beaten up. But if I hadn't been taught how to do one meditation, if I hadn't recognized that this was a skill, I'd just given away to anger, despair, you know, the whole shooting match.
Mm.
And what the walking meditation allowed me to do was to come from a place of, I describe it as no judgment. I have no judgment about his activities. And it was just to say, okay, that's there. Now what do I do? I always made the endeavor to come from a place of deep meditation. And when I did that, you know, I kind of said the right things and did the right things. When I came from anger, there's times I really got so ticked off, mm-hmm. so angry with the situation. I put the whole situation in jeopardy. But, you know, I also had to recognize the limits on me, the very real limits that, you know, there's only so much acid rock I can tolerate.
Or acid.
So in a sense, it was one occasion I saw the anger and I did walking meditation to no effect. And I just had to recognize, I am so angry, I'm out of here. And that as I left, the look of horror on my son's face, this lifeline was suddenly being jerked from underneath him. So brought me back to another realization that okay, my anger was, as the lady said over there, Zen koan, my anger was burning me to very good effect,
mm-hmm.
because the fear and desperation in my son's eyes allowed me to then come to a different accommodation. That okay, I wasn't in the state of squalid house anymore, but he could come and stay with me now.
But you're quite aware through it all, then, which is good, isn't it? So awareness can edify you in that way.
Yeah, but the thing is, if I didn't go back to the skillful use of walking meditation,
mm-hmm.
or make myself use that skill, I'd have been no use either to myself or to my son or to the community he was a part of.
And then you would have created karma.
That's right. Well,
and then you'd learn the lesson again. So it works. You get tested by life, and sometimes you do it well, sometimes you blow it. And blowing it is all right too, because you'll get a second chance. Or third, or fourth. And then sometimes you can't, you know, even though you're... One thing I like to reflect on is to really, every morning, try to make my intentions very clear. My intention is to not harm other beings and try to be of benefit to other sentient beings. Make that very clear in the morning. And then if I get overwhelmed with some emotion or some bit of wrong speech, I can reflect upon that as to try to be more mindful in that, but say that wasn't my intention. I didn't set myself up in the morning to be a nasty to someone. And I think that's helpful because the force of karma, the force of unskillful habits is powerful. And our idealism sometimes doesn't allow for that, and we get quite self-judgmental. But, you know, these energies, especially if we're, you know, if we've got a lot of different stresses on, they pop up. So always taking responsibility, but then saying, okay, I got to learn from that. And again and again and again and again. In Thai, they say, pit pen krul, mistake is teacher. It's a nice phrase. Brenda?
You said towards the beginning of your talk that in Buddhism there are no absolutes, and that you often hear the right or wrong kind of view. And I was wondering how you think that through in relationship to the precepts.
Well, for me, the precepts are guidelines for each of us to make our own choices. And to be very, very aware of where we're coming from in our choices. But why I like that, it's because it doesn't become a kind of, you know, a kind of fundamentalism of ideas, where then people begin to use precepts as a, you know, as a bludgeon. To, you know, you're not keeping them, so on. It's really up for each one of us to reflect upon and take responsibility. And then what you find with the precepts is there's a gradual refinement of that. You know, so right speech goes from lying and swearing to things like sensitive communication. You know, it's more and more refined that way. Say like not killing, if you make that an absolute, right? You make that an absolute. Never kill. And then you're not allowed to reflect upon that. You can't think clearly. But if you have the reflection, killing has a karmic result. You can't get out of that. Sorry. Killing has a karmic result. So if you kill, you're responsible. There's going to be some karmic effect. So that's the way Buddhism works with precepts. It says there is cause and there is effect. There is a result. Your choice, you make the choice. So like say, there is a couple in Northumberland who had a dog named Merlin. Merlin was a dog. And now Merlin couldn't bark because someone had chucked him out of a window because it was barking too much or something. Merlin had a hard life. But Merlin was now much loved and was older and older and older and older. And Merlin became crippled, became incontinent, blind, deaf, the whole business. So it was just sitting there. And this family had a little baby. Baby was crawling around and Merlin was making a mess. So they eventually decided to put it down. Right? Now they came to me and said, Venerable, can we kill Merlin? Yeah, it's not my problem, it's your pet. So that's it, you know, let someone else make the decision. I just say, well, there's a karmic result to killing. But there's a difference between shooting someone at the 7-Eleven to rob the place and putting down Merlin. There's a difference, obviously. Huh? But what is that difference? Don't know. I don't know what the karmic result is of putting Merlin down. I have no idea. But there is a karmic result. So there's always this kind of caution in Buddhism around what you do. But then what the person does, and they put Merlin down because they felt that was going to be the best thing they could get, you know, they could do with that situation. I didn't agree or disagree. I said, it's your choice. It's your pet. I said, this is the karma of having pets. This is the decisions that you make. And I kind of like that because it is very mature that way, I find. Rather than a, so I could say that's wrong, I could say that's right, but I don't know. I really don't know what the result of that is. But I know there's a difference. There's a huge difference, isn't it, to the intention. So you can see, like in terms of intention, if I plot to kill the neighbor, and I think about that for a whole year, and then I do it. Imagine the mind states that I'm, the unskillful mind states I'm cultivating to do that. And then I feel for this being, and I put it down. I mean, it's a whole different mind state. And that's what sometimes absolutism doesn't take into account, those kinds of things, you know, that life is different all the time. It's variable all the time. Does that do it?
Could we take that a bit further?
The dog?
The dog. Now, if the dog is such a tremendous pain and has an inoperable tumor, and you can't manage to lift or carry the dog, and its suffering is so great that you are hurting just as much as the dog is. No.
You're hurting because you don't want the dog to have suffering.
Yes.
There's something that you have that you don't want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, is there such a thing as, you know, putting the animal out of its agony from compassion?
Well, your heart is compassionate, but there's still the ending of its life in that particular way. And I don't know. I really don't know. Honestly.
It's very hard.
And so you get all the difficulties of our modern medical thing about euthanasia.
Absolutely.
You know, the ethical complexities that we're going to have to deal with is just very... And I think if the dialogue is very open in this way, rather than, you know, we taking absolute positions... And the dialogue is healthy in that way. And when we don't know, we will say we don't know. And then we'll make the best decisions that we can. But if we don't have that open... And I think that's kind of, for me, it's a kind of humility to say that I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible kind of caution too, isn't it? You know, we don't do these things easily. We think about them deeply. And then we make the decisions we make. And I think from that we'll get the best decisions possible.
Raises another question as to how clear one can be about one's intentions. I mean, in certain instances, sure, you know your intentions, it's clear, but there are subtleties when your intent, when your concern of compassion is mixed in with your own sense of discomfort and seeing suffering.
Yeah.
Where there is your own suffering and how the twain exists and whether one is able to resolve at that fine level, you know, my concern is only compassion and not my own discomfort. You know, there are subtleties there, I don't know. I guess in the practice of awareness, one gets enabled to resolve things finer and finer, but you know there is always that doubt whether one
you get
knows you, one's own intent.
Yeah, you get more and more aware of those kinds of things. Obviously, as one practices this. The subtleties of intention become more obvious, but that's life is a mixture always. It's not kind of black and white. But if one is like, if you use the Four Noble Truths and you say, what is it that I want that I don't have? What is it I don't want that I do have? Then at least you can see the aversion I have to this feeling, not wanting this being to suffer, which is okay. But then you're aware of, you know, maybe I'm using the drug to make myself comfortable, you know, so you bring that up into consciousness. But yeah, there's often not an easy answer.
You said that absolutes are not really in the state not very useful or.
Well, I said what I like about Theravada is that in the suttas and in the Vinaya, you don't find absolutes. And I find that very, very helpful because that prevents me from taking positions. So like the definitions of Nibbana are very vague. Peace.
Oh, great, you know.
And I think that's done specifically so that the mind doesn't get caught in just intellectual ideas about freedom, that actually freedom is actually realized.
But shouldn't there be some kind of foundation so that you have to build your system of thinking, your right of thought? Because otherwise you wouldn't be justified. You could justify anything.
Well, you have Paticca Samuppada, which is relativity. It's cause and effect. With this as condition, that arises. When this is not, that is not, that kind of thing. So that's what you build on. Attachment to craving and so on. But the sort of absolutes that a theistic religion might bring up, or that maybe a philosopher might bring up, the Buddha didn't operate in that way. He operated as an existentialist, actually. But he showed a way out. So there is a ground, yeah. There is sila, because sila has an effect. There's all of that, yeah. Cause and effect. So if you want to make that an absolute, that the law of karma is absolute, maybe that would be, that's what it's kind of based on. So there is a foundation. I was thinking more in a kind of philosophical sense where, you know, people take positions and argue about, you know, Buddhism is a religion or isn't a religion. Who cares? You know, that kind of thing. Alright?
Yeah. Another question. When it comes to the two of the themes that you're speaking on tonight, one was about the wisdom traditions, another one was about skillfulness. Because if we think about the mystic mind in different wisdom traditions, those minds that are realized and this provides the foundation for the different wisdom traditions, the expression of those awakened insights by mystical minds has different shape, has different form and expression depending on culture and social structure. Then for the person who is shopping or wanting to address what tradition suits them best, what skills do they need to discern unskillful expressions of the mystical mind? Obviously the Pope is quite unskillful in some of his expressions. And other practitioners in both Buddhism and Islam are also unskillful. So what I'm looking for the right word here, measuring stick or a set of skills are available to a lay person to find out, okay, what expressions of these wisdom traditions am I going to follow? What yardstick am I going to use to assess the skillfulness of the speaker or the writer?
Morality is one. Some Buddhism say the guru can't do one thing and everyone else does another thing. You know, like the guru says, well, you guys can't have whiskey, but I can. That's not on. So, I mean, just that is a good criteria, just morality, good basic morality. For me, a criteria is the ability to question, the ability to disagree. So, in other words, the ability to think and reflect. That's very, very important. For me also, when a teacher points to him or herself, I don't feel too inspired by that. But when a teacher points back to me, I find that helpful. So like with Ajahn Chah, they used to, people come to him, are you an arahant? He'd say, am I an arahant?
Yeah.
It's your problem. Just or when people ask confirmation from him, have I got the first stage of enlightenment? The same thing. He'd say, have you got the first stage of enlightenment? He wouldn't, you know, so he wouldn't confirm. He'd throw it always back to you. So I found that helpful. He was never pointing at himself. Rarely talked about his own experiences. And if he did, it was just about how he worked with meditation. It was always the teaching back to you. It's your responsibility. You've got to do it. So I found, and it's just my way, it's like, he never let me be dependent on him. In fact, you know, he'd send me off to branch monasteries, which I really resented. And things. So I think morality, the ability to question, making the person self-sufficient, that kind of thing. The ideas of transcendence are important for me. That it isn't just trying to kind of get the psychophysical process nice. That there is something deep in the human psyche, in consciousness that is transcendent. For me, that would make it religious. Those kinds of things. Most of the teachers I've had a good sense of humor, but that's not a given. I think the ability to question and challenge and say I disagree and that's very healthy, rather than the need to believe and such like. And morality, morality very, very important. So if a teacher is saying one thing to his students, and then off with the fairies doing something else, I don't trust that at all. I don't trust that. The idea that, like, there's a good story, just to finish off, because you probably don't want to get away, but there's a nice little story of Ajahn Sumedho, who was our American teacher in England, my teacher in England, and he was the senior Western disciple of Ajahn Chah, who has died, and who was a great meditation master in Thailand. He died in 91. And there's a third teacher called Buddhadasa in the south. Buddhadasa also died. He was a great, more academic, but also a great meditator. Now, so you have Ajahn Chah, who is the Thai, and Ajahn Buddhadasa. Ajahn Chah really emphasized Vinaya a lot. He emphasized the rules. You know, like, you guys wash your bowls right, and you walk this way, and you sit this way. And you really, really, real stickler for rules, which made you really mindful. Got up your nose, God, silly old man, leave me alone, I want to meditate. But he really, really used the rules to make you mindful. So Ajahn Sumedho so he's with Ajahn Chah for 5 years, and he goes down to Ajahn Buddhadasa. And Ajahn Buddhadasa didn't train Vinaya that much, didn't train in all the rules. And Ajahn Sumedho asked him, he said, well, what's the deal? How come Ajahn Chah says, got to keep all these rules, and you say, just be mindful? And he said, well, yeah, you just have to be mindful, that's all. And Ajahn Sumedho rather liked that, American, so kind of free form. So he went up to Ajahn Chah, and he asked Ajahn Chah, he says, now listen, you say we got to keep all these rules, but Ajahn Buddhadasa says we just have to be mindful. Who's right? And Ajahn Chah put it beautifully. He said, in Thai, tuk demai jing, jing demai tuk. And he says, it's true, but it's not right. It's right, but it's not true. He says, now, sure, just be mindful. But can you be mindful? Can you really be mindful moment by moment? Huh? And I don't think you can, actually. So that's why I say you keep the rules and really use them for mindfulness. And then he went on to say, he says, now, you think, why do I keep the rules? I keep the rules because I need to. Do you think if they gave me 1,000,000 baht, I'd run off with the ladies? And he says, no, I've got no problem that way. But I keep the rules so you keep the rules. And you keep the rules so the junior monks will keep the rules. And I thought I found it very inspiring, because he was really using himself as an example of impeccability. And he was impeccable, in all the little details of monastic life. And what was interesting, he was a monk that could train monks. Quite often monks, he was a monk's monk, hard to find, who put a lot of effort into just of every ordinary details. So that kind of impeccability I've always been impressed with. Impeccability in the way one operates. Like His Holiness I find very impeccable in the way he operates. Mother Teresa and people like that, they're impeccable. They live the way they talk. All right, so we could close. Thanks for your attention. Any announcements? Was there? I mean.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your announcement before you all. Of course, I want to thank you all for coming out here.